So I touched on the five faculties last night, and tonight I think it's a good topic. It contains a lot in a brief subject, and you also get two for the price of one. Now, what do I mean by that? Five faculties and five powers are identical. So you get 10 of the 37 requisites of enlightenment, and you only have to memorize five of them. As I mentioned last night, and I'm sure you all recall, the five faculties are faith, or saddha, and I'm going to spend quite a bit of time defining that, saddha, energy, virya, mindfulness, sati, concentration, samadhi, and wisdom, panya. So, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. These are a beautiful arrangement. It's interesting to speculate on how the Buddha came up with these organizational patterns and where they arrive in time in his teachings, because not everything is instantly developed. For instance, after his awakening, he said that he spent time reflecting on how the thing all works, and that's where he comes up with dependent origination. So this is developmental. Everything at the moment of his awakening, his enlightenment, everything was not fully, did not arrive instantly. It developed over time, so he had to develop strategies, teaching strategies, educational strategies. And you can see this in the development of the Sangha itself, the order of monks and nuns. He didn't lay down rules for them to begin with. I mean, it appears that he wasn't sure that there would be any monks. He hesitated to teach it at all. But then, having begun and having initiated five disciples who were apparently well-behaved, had intuition about what appropriate behavior and activities of the mind are for monastics, soon others arrived, and the initiating them into being monks was done almost instantly with the simple phrase, "Ehi Bhikkhu." So you want to be a monk? Okay, you're a monk. Now get some robes. That's all. And these fellows wandered off, and he seemed to have good intuition about who to ordain. But before long, he handed over this ordination process to a group of monks. And they didn't always choose the best candidates, and some of the monks behaved in an unmonkly manner. And so he would lay down a rule. So you can see it's developmental. And he also said, he was asked to, you know, give us all the rules. He would say, "I will know the time when it's appropriate for each one. We'll see how people behave, and we'll modify and change them as it goes." So it wasn't inflexible, it was developmental. And until you have over his lifespan, and basically there, just on the last day or two, he added a few rules to the Vinaya as well. So it was over the span of his life, and the teachings too, were given in sets. And it's obvious if you read the suttas, the first one is the turning of the wheel, Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. And now you get the basics laid out, Four Noble Truths. And then specific teachings for individuals. This teaching, I think, is very good for the lay community as well as the monastics. One thing that's presumed is that if you ordain that you have faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, you're going for a very deep commitment to the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and it's not a debate society. A lot of things are not open for discussion, really. It's presumed that you've passed the stage and you have some faith that the teachings of the Buddha, the Dhamma which he gives, the character of the Buddha himself, and the Sangha, which the ordained Sangha, are something which you are going to commit to and put some considerable faith and trust in. So this handful of teachings may not have been specifically just for monastics, but more for lay people. And the Buddha is articulating the fact that though he talks about, as we recited in the chanting, you see the Dhamma is ahipasko, something which you can examine for yourself. And there's a great emphasis, especially in the West, about how Dhamma is something that you is a self-revelation. It's something you confirm within your own experiences. And it's quite often, I suppose, left out in the teachings in retreat, meditation retreats, mindfulness retreats that are more or less conducted by lay people. And so this article of saddha, faith, is with the origins of the teachings and a very important. Of course, it's not the same kind of faith in things that you cannot confirm. There's a lot, various religions and so forth, that ask you for faith. And the faith has to be simply blind because you're never going to know directly. You simply have to presume that some vast superintelligence knows, and you do not, and all you have is faith. Possibility of faith. So the Buddhist approach to this is not that way. This is saying that there's some use to this idea that you can't know everything at the beginning, but you can develop and confirm for yourself some of these teachings through direct practice. And so that's what the last factor is, panya, wisdom, is the balancing factor for this saddha. A better translation rather than faith is a reasoned conviction. Some people ask each other, what do you believe? I've been asked this, what do you believe about this and that? And belief is not a very good word. That's a wild. You're just flinging yourself into something. Conviction is different. Conviction is that you actually will act on it. You will try it out. You have a conviction that something, you have a conviction, strong enough conviction, that you will try this. And so the Buddha is saying, well, you can't see it really at first, unless you practice this and try it out and examine this, and then you can have some sort of reasoned conviction about it, because it is a reasonable thing. What is the reasonable thing? So the Buddha is talking about truth, but not just, there's all kinds of truths. There's physical truths, there's social truths, there's psychological truths. And this is a particular truth, the only truth actually the Buddha is concerned with, and that is the truth of suffering, or the problem, the essential emotional distress in existence is the truth that he's talking about. So he's saying that this exists, suffering exists, that's true. And he's asking you now, look around, look at how it happens. You have your own personal experience of it, and that's where you go into examining this. And so that's where he's directing you to say, this is the supremely important truth. There are other truths, and he doesn't deny them. They're useful. You have to have a practical way to get through life. You have to have skills. You have to be able to measure things and weigh things and know what to do with your body and how to use your mind in interactions with other beings, etc. But those skills, and which might turn out to be truths as well, are not given pride of place. So the first, most important truth is, how does it feel? How does existence feel? And of course, these other practical matters are encouraged by the Buddha. He gives quite long lists and descriptions of how to succeed and support yourself and interact properly with others, because he knows that's a practical matter. And even for the monks, there's all kinds of details about day-to-day life, how to wear your robes, how to walk through the streets, how to share things with your fellow monastics, how to talk to the lay people, how to sit, how to stand, how to sleep, how long to sleep, when to eat, everything. So these are not neglected, but they're still the central truth of this whole matter is there is suffering, and that is very important. And what's important about it is that you shouldn't be too hasty in examining this, because without much reflection, when people ask about Buddhism, sometimes you can say, well, it's the truth of suffering, it's about suffering, and so forth. And they're thinking, well, I'm not suffering. Yeah, so somebody's suffering. Maybe that's why they need religion, but not me. So it's more or less a larger notion of how vulnerable and unpredictable, and how one is only necessarily a split second away from suffering. And you can't know that, and you can't know when it's going to arrive, how long it's going to last, if it'll arrive, etc. So he's asking you to inquire into that. And the faith part, the conviction part, is that if you really turn this over in your mind, this business about how many ways there are for things to go wrong, you will come to see this yourself, and you will see it'll unfold for you why he keeps making it the preeminent truth of existence. And it spiderwebs out into all kinds of other areas. It's also the view of life. So this is evolves into right view. And if you study right view, there are sort of initial right views, preliminary right views, which are more or less what the Buddha is advocating about a proper approach to existence. And some of them are not so hard to see. Some of them are interesting. He says, a mundane right view, a worldly right view, is that you have a special relationship to your parents. the fact that you were given birth and so forth is a special relationship, means there's a special, that's a special relationship. Or to whoever it was that raised you. Because you're helpless. Humans are not like cats or animals. We are completely helpless for a long time. So that's, and not everybody has that view. And you'll see that distress arises when people have complete alienation and rejection of any kind of special relationship to their caregivers, the ones who brought you up, etc. There'll be problem in the psyche. But that's just mundane right view. There's another level of the game, which is there is this world and there is another. So one of the convictions that you operate on, not necessarily knowing or having a great intuition about, is that it would be a mistake to bet 100% that this is it. This life is it. It's more or less too dangerous to wager on that. You can't afford to be wrong about that. So the Buddha asked, you know, there actually, we talk about, a next life and a rebirth and so forth. And of course, in Buddhism, we talk about previous lives. And this is one of the convictions or something to take up as a point for reflection, and without perhaps any intuition about the truth of it or not. The way some of the enlightened disciples, some of the arhats had no recollection of a previous life. They didn't have any direct knowledge of a previous life, and they didn't necessarily have any psychic capacity to see into other realms. But they had enough conviction in the inescapable nature of suffering that they laid all their money on, symbolic money, on one bet. And that is that it would be precarious to wager that there is no continuation. It's just too dangerous a bet to wager on that. And so they were convinced enough to generate the energy that it takes. See, this view that it's not just this life and it ends and it's essentially meaningless, and that's it. So they, having considered the situation, were energized enough to commit to a solution which would be more than just taking account of this life, but literally any life, the possibility of any situation or continuation. How is it in any possible situation that suffering could arise? And what would be the solution to that? How would you dissolve that difficulty in any conceivable existence? So this is what the saddha, this conviction, has to have some element that motivates you. Otherwise, And a person who has a very deep and absolute conviction that there is just this life, you popped out of nothing and you return to nothing. If that is your complete conviction, you will not have motivation to practice these meditation structures that change your relationship to life itself. You will remain in a more or less sensory experience. Your moral boundaries will be flexible. and not committed, because there is part of the conviction is that there are no extensive consequences to any particular action except what happens in this life externally. And so the Buddha is saying that this right view and conviction are very intertwined. It's about motivation. Lots of people actually start a meditation because life is unsatisfactory, or they're just curious, and then they does change the way you think about things. And just practicing, focusing and concentrating and so forth, and being aware of the inner dynamics of your mind is a revelation, and it changes a lot of people. That will go so far, but it can easily, the motivations don't carry on past a certain point. And a lot of people are not all that, in discussions about this, they're not often all that honest about that. But what you actually believe and what your convictions are will be revealed in how you conduct your life and how much time and importance you give this practice of Dhamma. There's an interesting book by an English philosopher named John Gray, and it's called Seven Kinds of Atheists. It's not the only book he's written, but I was reading some of his surveys of religions. He's an atheist, but he has quarrels with various types of atheists that are obnoxious and various, etc. And what he talks about is basically atheist tends to be a Western term. It's not really it doesn't have all the implications. When you come into a Buddhist culture, this idea of atheism doesn't have all of the red flags that go up in the West, because you're either a theist or you're an atheist. And atheist means you have no conviction of anything beyond this life. It's a pure materialist conviction. But whereas in Buddhism, it doesn't mean that at all. There's all kinds of variations. You can have no concept of God, but you can have a perfectly clear concept of heaven, hell, all of these things, and all the possible realms you can go to, and nothing to do with whether you believe in a God or not. But he means something like that, that you're a convinced nihilist, materialist. And he talks about it in his own view of things, why he doesn't practice meditation, or why he is not a Buddhist. He's appreciative, actually, of Buddhism. Most of the Western philosophers of modern times actually are very appreciative of Buddhism. They recognize this is high philosophy. This is impressive. But he's honest about it. He says, well, why don't I take up these meditation processes? And he said, because I don't know how much time I have. I don't know how long it'll take me to get any benefit from it. And, you know, since I don't have any conviction of beyond this life, then I'm not motivated to do this. But see, that's really nice and open and honest. This, like, do you really have this practice of meditation, this contemplative practice? You don't know how long this is going to take, and you could be doing other things that might have more immediate gratification, you know? And that's why most people don't meditate. Because just sitting in there in an empty room, watching your breath and hallucinating and stuff, there's other things to do. So that's where you see, this is where conviction is. Like, I ask myself, having gone through all of the philosophical traditions and questioning this and questioning that, so why do I keep doing this? You know, why do I keep spending so much of my time on this. I don't actually ask myself that now, but I'm talking, 40 years ago. So, 40? No, that's an exaggeration. 35 years ago, yeah. No. Yes, 40 years ago, yeah. Okay, I'm getting my 37 requisites. 69 years, 40 of, yes. So more than 40 years ago. So that's where the rubber hits the road, actually, is like, you have some choices here. You don't have to do this. Most people don't. And probably in the middle of a number of retreats, you'll be saying, why am I doing this? And you'll find out whether you have conviction or not. See, because there's this nagging doubt that, like, really, it's not a good bet to bet that it's just this material thing and annihilation, etc. What if I'm wrong about that, you know? So this is this whole element. This is conviction. And it just hooks in with panya, which is on the other end of the teeter-totter, wisdom. So these five faculties. So if the first one is this saddha, this reasoned conviction, thinking very seriously about, wait a sec, what is this thing called existence? Anybody know anything here? I went to university hoping that somebody knew something. That's why I went into philosophy. No, nobody knew anything. So this is the situation that's really important to have the question, the existential question, being very important. And it's very clear that it has something to do with wisdom as well. It also causes trouble in your life. If you're smart enough to have doubts and to question things, there will be trouble. But on the other hand, if you're not smart enough to question and don't care enough, there will be great trouble, very great trouble. So this is just less trouble. You can't basically have no trouble. Well, there was an arahant who was 8 years old. He seemed to have no trouble. There was also Mozart. Any of you play the violin like that? Play the piano? Compose symphonies by the time you're six? No. Okay, so we have trouble. We have to work it out. We have to learn. So this is this balance, this relationship between willingly going into the unknown and doing this meditation stuff and then reflecting on this Dhamma and reading and listening to these talks and then going to retreats and stuff. And in extreme cases, actually going into the robes and like all of that. That's a radical departure from everything. And this is walking into the unknown. You're walking into the unknown doing this. And others are thinking, why would you do something like that? But they're also, they don't know they're walking into the unknown as well. That's why they're shocked and horrified and distressed when it turns out they are walking into the unknown and something happens. Something bad happens. Not just one thing, two things, five things, three things all at once. Stuff happens. So this complacency that people have, and they're not taking up, they're not taking chances, they're not trying, they're not inquiring, they're not doing this. They do not get off the hook. It happens to them. Wisdom is the balancing factor because you can also be a little too eager to believe things. And as you see out there are all kinds of very shallow, very ridiculous ideas that are embraced wholeheartedly, desperately. And in some of those teachings, you're encouraged to just surrender all reflection and critical thinking. So the Buddha is asking you not to do that, that it's not that kind of philosophy, it's not that kind of religion. It's one that requires, you can't just believe. It won't help. It's something that helps move you along, but you can't get there by that. You have to actually reflect. And that's the wisdom, that you have to decide, what is being said here? What is the Buddha telling me to do? What are these seven factors of enlightenment? What are these hindrances he's talking about? What am I supposed to do about anger? What am I supposed to do about doubt? What am I supposed to do about being fatigued, dull? That's just me. That's my authentic self, isn't it? No. So I have to question my authentic self, etc. This is what the Buddha's. You're thinking. So how do I deal with this? Who am I? Who am I really? And is it all just illusion? Can I change everything about myself? What's the center? Is there a center? So these are the things that you have to keep inquiring into. And this is this panya, this is this wisdom factor. But if you can't pay attention, wisdom is not enough. So that's why we need to cultivate mindfulness. We can't seem to stay on the topic. Our mind flits around too much to get to any conclusions. We forget what we were doing. We forget to inquire. We forget to take a chance to walk into the unknown. We forget that. We get distracted. So the Buddha is giving exercises for paying attention, and he keeps pushing your nose into the four foundations of mindfulness, the body, the feelings, the mind itself, and the structures which make sense of this body, feelings, mind, how to look at them, how to make sense of them, how to organize that. So at the same time you're looking at the problem itself, the situation itself, which is your body, your feelings, your mind, you are also being told, now look at it this way. Here, look at this situation. Look at the body in this context. Now try it in this context. Look at it this way and that way. How about your feelings? How about your bodily feelings? How about your emotional feelings? Look at them this way and that way. Can you even name them? Do you have an idea which category? How are you feeling? Can you name it? Can you tell me what it is? Is it pleasant or painful or neutral or what? So these are the topics, but having received these topics, the fact that you're looking at them actually changes your mind. So this is the development of mindfulness, the capacity to sustain attention on these subjects. And the more you do it, the more your capacity to sustain attention increases. As you can see in modern neurology and so forth, if you start playing the violin when you're three and they'll look at your brain. Your brain is changing. If you play an instrument deeply or play chess for years and years, your mind changes. It responds to the situation. So this is what mindfulness is. He's giving you exercise, things to look at, and at the same time, the thing that looks at it is getting stronger. It gets more fluent with this, and that changes everything. You start to see things differently. You experience things differently. But mindfulness is at the service and support of wisdom and your conviction as well. And what you need to do this is energy. You need to carry it out with energy. So that's the second factor. And if you manage to balance these factors, these four factors, the fifth one arises. And that is the sign that the other four are coming into strength. And that is samadhi, concentration. You can't get it. If the other factors are weak, you can't get it. If your conviction, for instance, just sitting down to meditate, you know, notice that, yes, it's time to meditate. But I want to just think about that situation at home first. I'm here to meditate. It's a retreat. And then 20 minutes goes by and you realize, I haven't even started to meditate yet. I haven't got the conviction that now is the time to actually pay attention to my breath. And so that's weak. Or I'm too tired. The energy isn't there. So if you don't have these, and if you don't have the wisdom, think, now this is the time to put aside these other things and focus. This is important. And I know why it's important. So that's wisdom. If those things happen, if you get this, the conviction to go in, because there's a hesitation to just cancel the random pattern, thinking patterns, and stay with one thing. That's like, people are afraid to do that. Quite often at the beginning of meditation, people are like, they've never controlled their mind in their whole life. They've never canceled thoughts, dismissed thoughts, and gone to this. And it can feel dangerous. It can feel, if I stop being myself, because all of this, your natural flow of thoughts is like who you think you are. It's like, it's your natural self. Whatever comes up, that's me. And they're telling you to dismiss you. You're being told to dismiss your natural process and pay no attention to it and just go to this. That's a strange cancellation of more or less your sense of self. And that comes up. People are afraid that they might stop thinking. And that's the only way to get to samadhi, is you're going to have to do that. You're going to have to stop thinking. The fact that we do that every night when we sleep for 8 hours escapes people's attention sometimes, that you do this on a regular basis. You go into a very mystical, weird trance where you're apparently lifeless for 6-7 hours. I mean, if only a few people did that, first of all, nobody would believe that it was real. But everybody does it. It's incredible. Weird. So we're actually doing this consciously. We're abandoning the random discursive activity of the mind, following this little thought and that little thought and this little song and that little poem and that little daydream. So this is doing something that's unusual to the normal human mind. And only if you're successful with this, the fourth factor will come up, the samadhi. And samadhi then, instantly when samadhi comes up, and or maybe instantly after you have the experience of samadhi for some period of time, wisdom will arise. Because it'll be a revelation that a lot of the manufacturing of the world, which is your thought process, is just that. It's just thought process, because you successfully suspended it for a period of time and you felt wonderful for no external reason. And then you're confronted with the fact that you're a bit crazy. Normal activities of the mind are fantasies and projections, and the source of suffering. So this is plays back with wisdom. Aha, so I'm doing it to myself. Okay, I found out who the culprit is. Turns out it's me. Yeah, it was me. You know, you have this question in relationships, right? Is it him or is it me? Or is it them or is it me? It turns out it's you, yeah. And this is revealed when you have samadhi. You stop doing it to yourself. And that triggers with wisdom. And that increases your faith because suddenly you saw it yourself. Now, that's what the Buddha is saying. Now, tomorrow I'm going to talk about the same thing, except it's called powers now. Why is reason, conviction, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, why are they sometimes called faculties, and why are they sometimes called powers? And what's the difference between saddha, faith, as a faculty, and faith as a power? We will leave this hanging in the air for tomorrow.